got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, what's up? How are you?
Doing just great. Having a really good time with some refereeing national panel grants, things that are part of the service you do to the industry, and I'm glad it's done.
Yeah, sounds very fancy pants. So good for you. Good for you. It's exciting stuff.
It really is. When you see the really exciting science that's taking place around the country, and the groups that are getting around different issues. And we're not just talking about biology or genetic engineering, but in so many different fields. It's really exciting. And hearing that we're getting a 20% bump in federal science funding, we need that bad. I mean, it really need it badly. So really exciting times.
Well, very good. And speaking of science, let's dive into our stories this week. We've got some very innovative things to talk about, I think. So first up, skeptical of Aqua Bounty's fast-growing salmon? Well, nature makes genetically modified fish, too. Next up, why the effort to find a, quote, biological basis for being transgender is misguided and harmful. And finally, cure for sickle cell diseases inches closer with the launch of a major gene therapy trial. Very exciting stuff. But first up, Kevin, let's talk about natural GM fish, apparently.
Yeah, this is really cool. And this is a report that came out in CBC News, which is Canadian Broadcasting Company, usually not writing very favorable things about genetic engineering, because this isn't genetic engineering unless it's genetic engineering that nature did. So the story goes back to a couple of researchers at Queen's University, Lori Graham and Peter Davies. They found this evidence a while ago now that there was this antifreeze gene that helped the rainbow smelt live through freezing temperatures. So super cooling, that fish and some other organisms can endure temperatures below freezing because of mechanisms that keep their cells from forming ice crystals. A lot of interesting stuff going on there. And if you think about it, these are cold-blooded. So when it gets below freezing, you have the risk of freezing. So years ago, a decade and a half, I guess, they found this evidence that there was this gene that didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense, that it looked like so we go over now to herring and smelt. How was this herring gene ending up in smelt? The last time that they were related was by an extremely distant ancestor. And they said by the article here, 250 million years ago. So that was like in the Carboniferous period. So these two individual lineages of fish split off pretty early, back before dinosaurs. And so this is really cool stuff. Well, same time as early dinosaurs. So how the heck did this happen? So what it seems more likely to have happened is that in a relatively contemporary setting, the one gene has jumped from herring to smelt. Makes no sense. How does that happen? And so that's really where this story stepped off.
Well, let's get into that if we can, because if you're not talking about sexual reproduction, how is this occurring? How are you getting this DNA from one species that's very distantly related to another? Can you elaborate on some of the details of that?
Well, that was the really big question, right? How does this come up? How does this happen? Well, what was really cool was that they went and actually had access to the gene sequences or the genomic sequence of the herring and the smelt, and you could look at them together. So you look at the rainbow smelt sequence and the herring sequence together, and what you see is that let me even go back one. If you look at the sequence of the rainbow smelt and compare that to the other smelts. They have what's called syntony. You have the same shared sequence of all of the genes in the region. And it turns out that this one has the same as other smelts, except for one gene. It has this antifreeze gene, which has been inserted into the normal smelt genome. So you have this exact match with all the other smelts, except for this one herring gene that's right there in the middle. Now, how the heck does that happen? And the way that that is proposed to it happen, this is a hypothesis, is that it is happening with the help of transposable elements. Transposable elements are mobile pieces of DNA that get up out of DNA and move in the genome, sometimes replicating themselves, other times jumping out and landing somewhere else. So they have sequences on their ends which are known to be able to integrate back into DNA. So what is proposed to have happened is that apparently there may have been, and this is the guess, that either sperm from herring that contained this gene next to a transposable element broke down, because, you know, this stuff is just released in water, and maybe it goes and finds an egg. Most of it doesn't. It breaks down, and then that DNA is released into the water. And when the DNA is released into the water, now if it lands on an egg and somehow taken up by that egg, it has these adjacent sequences next to it that say, incorporate me into your DNA, which is apparently what it did. Because when you look at this genetic sequence, you see the evidence of the transposable elements. So that's the best hypothesis. Not too different than what happens with agrobacterium when we make a genetically engineered plant.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. And it leads me to the two reasons I really, really like this story. The first is that it underscores an important point, namely that scientists are more or less copying from nature, because you only have what the world offers you, really, right? You can come up with great ideas, but if it doesn't comport with what happens in reality, it doesn't matter how creative you are, right? So, like, for example, when you talk about antifreeze, you know, you would see these scare memes online. They'd say they're putting antifreeze in fish or antifreeze in tomatoes or whatever. And when people hear that word, they think of this blue stuff that they put in their car, right? So it just sounds very unnatural and synthetic and evil, maybe. But it's just copied from nature. So that's the first thing I think is really cool. It just underscores that this advanced science we're doing is more or less, it comes from what we have to work with. And then the second point is that the peer review process seems to have worked very well in this case, because the two researchers behind this project had trouble getting their original paper published because the reviewers said, you know, we're really skeptical of this. You need better evidence. So they went back, they did more experiments. They came back, they said, okay, here's what we found. And then they got the paper published, and then they got subsequent research published. And now you have a real viable hypothesis that's actually convinced people. And I think that's great to see today, especially because we talk a lot about these really bad studies that make it through peer review. And when we break them down, I'm just left asking as a layman, like, how did this get through? You know, so it's just encouraging on those two fronts. What are your thoughts?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, the whole process of plant genetic engineering is just exploiting a natural process. You know, we borrow a mechanism from bacteria to move a gene. But I agree with you on all these other things too. The interesting thing about this, finding this, is that when you start to look across genomes, like genome sequencing is such a hot area, and we've gone from a handful of genomes sequenced in 2010 to probably a million now. And when you consider all the different organisms that have been sequenced, and when you look across sequence data, you find things that don't make sense. And usually you discount it. You say, oh, it must be a contaminant. And there's got to be this entire new field that can open up that says, maybe these are valid. Maybe these are legitimate signals that are showing up from a genetic transformation, a horizontal gene transfer event. And I would think that's going to be a really exciting area for people to look, because if you can find the weirdness and then go back and experimentally validate it, we may find dozens or hundreds or thousands of examples of where gene transfer occurs naturally. And I think it's going to open a whole new interesting area of science.
Very exciting stuff, and we will definitely keep following it. But let's move on to, I guess what I'd say is probably our most controversial story, maybe in a while, actually, about this idea that we shouldn't search for a biological basis for people who are transgender, Kevin. So what's going on here?
Yeah, and the reason I really like this story and the reason I selected this one for today's discussion is because I'm interested to know what you think, and I'm interested to know what the audience thinks. This area of transgender is a really important one, because we've talked about this before. You know, I'm under the impression that this is a completely normal part of human development. It's things that happen. It's development of the hardware and the software at different times. And I've known lots of transgender people in my life and see what they endure. And so I have a lot of empathy for their situation, and really have seen this firsthand. So when you start to talk about a biological basis for being transgender, and this article is by Nat Mulkey in Scientific American, he posits, or she posits, we don't know if it's Nathan or Natalie, or in between, right? That it brings about this idea of biological essentialism, that there has to be some sort of biological reason for why you are the way you are. And that the hazard of this is that then you have people who try to cure you with conversion therapy, that there's ways that you can be fixed of this unacceptable tendency, unacceptable, certainly in quotes. There's been a lot of studies to investigate this, one by a guy named Dick Swab. Yeah, I know. I spit my coffee on the screen when I read that. You know, in the times of COVID, you know, you think of swabs and, you know, but he says that there were differences between male and female brains cis and transgender brains. And there's other folks who've made these discussions. Now, here's the question for you, though. The author of the article says that all of this trying to identify a biological basis is bad. But I really always thought that I would feel, and if I was transgender, or someone who is transgender, would like to know that there is a biological basis for them to exhibit the tendencies they do and the feelings they have. And that with that comes a validation that it's not just a behavior, not just the choice you make. There's a root for this that makes sense biologically. And that's how I would interpret it, but I think I would disagree with the author.
I would as well, and I think I would probably go a little bit further than you, and I would just call this article, with all due respect, just nonsense. I don't believe this for one minute, and let me point out a few things. So this is a quote. I guess this would be the thesis of the article. So the author says, "The search for a biological cause of transness, also known as biological essentialism, may be well-intentioned, but it is a dangerous path that leaves little room for a real understanding of gender and gender identity." Now, I don't like this because it builds into the argument, the idea that opposing it is somehow offensive or maybe even discriminatory, when in reality, all you're doing is you're trying to get at the underlying basis for a given behavior or a given characteristic. And I don't think in any other aspect of life would we say, we're going to just cut off this kind of research because we're uncomfortable with what people might do with it. I think that's probably happened with IQ research. I've seen people say, we just need to stop investigating this because the implications make us uncomfortable. And that's just ridiculous to me, you know? And I want to be clear, I'm not saying we need to do this research so we can establish particular policies or treat trans people a certain way. That's not what I'm getting at all. But if there is a biological basis to this, we need to investigate it because it's good to know what causes people to behave certain ways, whatever that behavior is. And I think what this person's doing in the thesis is saying, well, if you disagree with this by default, you're sort of already, you know, out of the acceptable discussion. And I just think that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's, if you look at 23andMe and many of these other article or these methods that help you analyze traits associated with DNA sequence, there's a lot of discussion of if you're an extrovert, you might have this, or if you're introverted, you might have this genetic basis. And there is a genetic basis to lots of our behaviors. And I certainly feel that that there is a biological basis, maybe not a genetic basis for trans tendencies. It could be more of a developmental and a timing and a genetic by environment effect that happens during gestation. I mean, there's a lot of different things, and we've talked about that before. But the bottom line is that I also disagree with the author. I think that if you asked anybody I know who's trans, they would say it's good to know that there is a biological reason for why I feel the way I do, because when your whole life through either discrimination or by the words of others, you've felt out of place, really realizing that you certainly have a place because it's a biological basis for it. I think that is actually a really positive thing if we flip this article upside down.
Yeah, there's so much we could say, but one other important thing I want to stress is that I think this is another example of what we talked about a few weeks ago when we were talking about people and more generally women who reject well-established cancer therapies because they accept postmodernism or they accept one of these kind of alternative worldviews, if you will. And I think this is another example of that, where you have an idea that's rooted in critical theory or, you know, the more academic side of the social justice movement. And built into that is the idea that we need to come up with theories that make the world a more equitable or a more just place. And that's good. That's fine. You know, if you see something wrong in the world and you want to change it. But I think when you let that sort of methodology creep into science, you're not doing science anymore, because you're in science, you're trying to discover how the natural world works. And maybe part of that is manipulating how things behave in the natural world. But I think this author comes to this and he says, you know, the way that you think about this is wrong. And so I'm going to change how you think about this. And if you don't like that, you're part of the problem. And I just think that needs to be resisted. And I'll give you the obvious example is COVID-19. You know, the scientific establishment, the mainstream press, they're all harping on people to trust the science, follow the science, you know, listen to the public health experts. And at the same time, you have major publications like Scientific American championing this idea. And I think what that's going to lead to is a situation where people look at this and they go, okay, well, these same people are telling me that I have to trust the science when they tell me to, but on these other questions, I'm not even allowed to ask scientific questions about the topic. And I just think that's chaos. That's just not going to lead to a good place.
No, I agree with you. I think it's very true. I wonder if the author is trans. We should probably reach out and ask, because it does mention in here, you know, at the end that we need to be thinking about this to understand their experience. And I'm guessing that that's kind of a tip off that they are, as they say here, TGNB, transgender non-binary. I'm getting an acronym fatigue. I think we're running I thought it was a yogurt store, TGM. I'm getting worn out of all the different letters that we use, but I understand, you know, the idea of identity within a community and that kind of thing and the support that you get therein. But overall, I hope the author does contact us and share some thoughts, because it's important for us to understand these things as a cis community in order to make the right moves with respect to others. And that's just why I brought this up.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I just want to stress, you know, I'm not here. It's not my role in this world really to tell individual people who they are or how they're supposed to live. If you're an adult and if you've made a decision that you're going to live a certain way, you know, more power to you. That's fine. I don't care about that. But I just think the fact that you're trying to attach how people do their work to a particular moral framework just goes over the line. But
that's right. I judge a man by his character, not by his eyeshadow.
There, yeah. Yeah, put it on one of those motivational posters. All right, so let's talk about far less controversial note. Well, maybe not, but let's talk about gene editing for curing sickle cell, Kevin.
Yeah, this is, you know, another article that I hope we don't seem to be redundant, but we covered gene editing for sickle cell last year, and I didn't want to make it sound like we're just repeating the same story, but this is a disease that affects 100,000 Americans, most of them African American, but anybody with recent African derivation will have a potential to carry the gene alleles or gene variants that can lead to sickle cell disease. And this is an awful disease. It's where a mutation in hemoglobin changes the way, so the protein that carries the oxygen in the blood, where how the hemoglobin doesn't fold correct, and the little raft, erythrocyte, the red blood cell, that looks like a little raft, folds into a banana, a sickle, you know, this pointy thing. And it gets lodged in small capillaries. They cluster together. They get stuck in small blood vessels, and they cause tremendous pain. And people who get this usually don't live very long. They live painful lives. They die early. They have all kinds of other health-related problems with anything that has small vessels, so kidneys and things like that. So it is a major problem for a lot of people. Now, gene therapy has come along to try to come up with ways to fix this. And the reason it's an attractive target is because you can presumably heal somebody of this disease. You can cure them because you don't need to correct every cell in their body with a new genetic correction. All you need to do is correct one blood cell precursor, one of these hematopoietic stem cells. All you have to do is correct the mistake in that cell and then make a bunch more blood cells and then kill the blood cells, the bone marrow of the person, and then inject the new stuff in. And the new cells you put into them with the corrected copy of the gene will go into the marrow and populate their body with corrected blood. And they've done it in other ways, and I won't go into the details of that. It was on Talking Biotech. It's been other ways to do this, and that's working beautifully. This is going to be trials for another method that instead of just turning on fetal hemoglobin, which is what they do in the other mechanisms, here they're adding a corrected version of the gene in place of the damaged version. And this is really exciting stuff. And the trials are going to begin shortly.
So my understanding is that the difficult part is the knock-in part, right? It's not too difficult to use CRISPR to cut out the defective gene, but it's inserting the copy of the functioning one. That can be challenging. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, that's really important. So the CRISPR-Cas9. So the Cas9 enzyme is the molecular scissors that go to the genome, go into your DNA, and they cut at a place where you decide it should cut. Scientists give it a little piece of instructions called a guide RNA that take that enzyme to the place where it needs to do its job, and then it cuts that space. Now, usually it cuts it, and then it gets repaired with something called non-homologous end joining, where just the repair mechanism is sloppy, and so it makes mistakes. And so that's how you're able to remove the function of a gene using gene editing with CRISPR-Cas9. You are able to cut the gene and have it come back together in a sloppy way. Now you can use the same mechanism to fold in a new gene into that space or a correction into that space. But again, when you make the correction, it doesn't always work right, and there's errors around it. So there's only a small population of blood cells that actually do get it correct. But you can select for those. And if you can get, culture those cells and identify the ones that are right and get those into the person, then that person can become repopulated with the corrected stem cells. That's pretty exciting stuff.
I think what's coolest about this is that it's headed to trials now, because so much of the research that we talk about and so much of the news people read, it's either very abstract or it's in very preliminary stages where they're doing it in animals or they're doing it in cell culture. And so, you know, it might proceed, it might not, there's just no idea. But this, at least from my reading of it, this seems like a very viable treatment. They have to do the trials to make sure it's safe and effective, but this is pretty enormous progress, isn't it?
This one makes me so happy, because I'll tell you what, it will work. I'll go out on a limb on that one. There's no question that this will work. You're taking the incorrect information off the hard drive and putting the right information on it. you know, and this is something that I can say with tremendous confidence will be a very effective therapy. And that's where you get into these funny areas now where you start saying, well, how do you know? So we only have 100,000 people who need to get it, and it costs between $500,000 and $750,000 a person to get it. The beautiful part of this is that once it's approved and once it works, I bet this is the kind of thing that you can do almost like a Jiffy Lube, that someone will be able to go in as an outpatient, receive the chemotherapy to ablate their bone cells, their bone marrow cells, and then receive the infusion of the new cells, which you just put into your arm like a normal blood transfusion. And what's so cool is that blood cells, the stem cells, they know where they're supposed to go, and they'll go into the bone marrow and repopulate it. Really, really neat.
Excellent stuff. Well, we will follow this story too. And I don't think it's a problem to talk about this more than once, because it's cool research and it's advancing at a pretty rapid rate. So we will keep on it. But Kevin, who are you following on Twitter this week?
Yeah, this week I'm following Dr. Susie Wiles. And I don't know if you know Susie Wiles. S-O-U-X-I-E Wiles. And she was just named New Zealander of the Year. You know, there's a small pool there. It's only 35,000 COVID-free people, or 35 million, 35 million. That's off by 1,000. but the real thing to her credit, and you check out her stuff, is that she does a lot of great science communication around the issue of COVID-19. And she found herself in this area much as we have. And she just done a great job with cartoons, infographics, really great ways to communicate the pandemic and worth looking at. And it's spelled S-I-O-U-X-I-E Wiles. So if you go to look that up, that's where she is.
All right. I'm going to recommend people follow another science news site called Science 2.0. And if you want to jump online, it's just science20.com. And this is Hank Campbell's site. I mentioned Hank last week, and I figured since I mentioned it by name, I should just plug his website too. But it's a great site. And what I love about it, and this has been replicated at other places now, but what I really like about the site is that it's a blog for scientists, and it's useful. It's actually, and to be completely transparent, this is where I started my science writing career over a decade ago now. But it's useful if you want on just about any topic. You know, you have experts writing there, you can interact with them. This was sort of like, I want to say it was kind of like Twitter before Twitter became what it is in that respect. But it's a great site. So if you want to follow them, it's at science2_0 on Twitter. And with that, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Follow us on Twitter as always at CamJEnglish, at Kevin Folta, geneticliteracyproject.org. And we will see you next week.